Today at Reader's Corner, Jeffrey Wasserstrom, author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Somehow in the way that the news about China gets filtered down, the more the diversity of the place gets reduced down to these generalizations about the Chinese. There are tens of thousands of protests involving a significant number of people every year in China. And they take place on a range of issues, and they're met with a variety of responses by the state. There's really a search for meaning going on in China that has something to do with declining belief in the faith-like aspects of Chinese communism.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. 30 years ago, China rarely made the headlines. Today, the economic powerhouse is in the news every day for its rapid growth or its politics or even for its sports. Yet despite this intense coverage, there are still numerous misconceptions about China, particularly on the part of Americans. Today's guest, Dr. Jeffrey Wasserstrom, is the author of 4 books on China and the editor or co-editor of several more. In China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, he traces the country's history and rapid rise and provides succinct answers to big questions about China. Dr. Wasserstrom is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, and the editor of the Journal of Asian Studies. He also is the Asia editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, an associate fellow of the Asia Society, and a co-founder of the China Beat, a blog which was a 4-year effort, now concluded, to educate the public about China. Dr. Wasserstrom joins us today by phone for this interview. Jeffrey Wasserstrom, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's great to be on.
Well, let's begin with the Republic of China, created in 1911. Until then, the country was ruled by emperors and by dynasties. To what extent do these historical legacies still define present-day China's trajectory, or maybe we should say, is the past prologue as far as predicting what is going to come of China in these years ahead of us?
Well, I think the past remains relevant in all kinds of ways. There's the actual past in the terms of legacies of sort of patterns of behavior, political and otherwise, that show up again up to the present. But there's also the kind of imagined and used past, which is true in every country, but I think it has a particular importance in China because of the ongoing notion by leaders within China that there was a long period of Chinese greatness, of China being the central power of the region, and to some extent being the greatest power on earth, or as much of the world as people in China knew. And this sense that a dark period set in with events like the Opium War in the middle of the 19th century, and then in 1895, China was defeated by Japan in a war, which caused a kind of questioning within China of the need to do more of what Japan had done, which had been to selectively borrow and adapt things from Western powers to strengthen itself. And so the 1911 revolution, before that, there were various efforts, last-ditch efforts by the Qing dynasty to implement various reforms. And as Tocqueville has taught us, among others, one way that regimes fall is when they try to reform and it's seen as too little, too late. And that 1911 revolution was a way of saying that simply tinkering with the system wasn't going to be enough, that there needed to be a full-scale transformation. And I bring this up as just one example of how the past can influence contemporary debates. There's been a big debate in China recently about whether in the future there might see another kind of revolution yet again, or reform, and how reform can be carried out without being seen as too little, too late. And in fact, one bestseller in China recently, after a Chinese official mentioned reading it, has been Tocqueville's book on the French Revolution and the Ancien Regime.
Well, that's really interesting. I wonder if the new Communist Party leader, Xi Jinping, is ready for the kind of reforms that have been predicted. Is he likely to be the kind of new leader that will go in this direction?
Well, there's been a bit of a debate going on among people watching China. It's not that I'm sure that Xi Jinping won't be somebody who does dramatic opening up things. We've been surprised by China continually in the last 30 years. But so far, Xi Jinping doesn't seem to be making clear signs of moving that way. And we should just remember that 10 years ago, Hu Jintao, the leader before Xi, when he came into power, somebody we knew very little about, there was a big desire to find in his profile and in parsing his speeches signs that he would do things radically differently.
Well, your case in point really underscores the fact that it's very difficult to get China right. And I guess that brings on the question of what is the most common thing you think Americans get wrong about China?
Well, I think one mistake which kind of comes up why I don't want to be in a straightforward debate of matching one prediction against another is I think there's a tendency in the U.S. to either be too optimistic and sort of starry-eyed about China at some periods and then swing from that to being too dark about it and see China either as on the verge of somehow magically becoming the country we always dreamed it would be, and the United States and China having this wonderful relationship going forward, or overemphasizing the China threat. I think that's been the biggest problem with American views on China. And Americans misunderstand a lot of different parts of the world, different countries. But I think that kind of love-hate dimension of intense interest in China much of the time and a desire to either project our hopes onto it or project very dark fears on it. And we see that sometimes even at the same moment during the Tiananmen Rising in 1989, we overstated the degree to which the students on the square were inspired by American ideas. So we read into this idea that if the students' movement succeeded, somehow China would be Americanized. In fact, a lot that was going on in that protest was about distinctive things to China's situation. It's what I call sometimes big bad China and the good Chinese way of thinking. This idea that somehow there could be this magical connection between the American people and the Chinese people, but also then a projection of the evilness of the state getting in the way. And when a new leader comes in and there's a lot of fascination with maybe he could be this different kind of leader, it's the way of our trying to square that combination. And we've just been wrong a lot. In the 1930s, some in America thought Chiang Kai-shek, who was married to a Wellesley-educated woman, Song Mei-ling, and who seemed, you know, to embrace Christianity and to talk about democracy, that he would be the one who could bring China in step with our ways. And of course, he turned out to be a very authoritarian figure who was not interested in democratizing China, that was interested in some things that linked up with American values and American ideals, but in other ways was very much not in step with that. And we've seen that pattern over and over again with overstated hopes and then a swing toward jilted lover idea of just demonizing the other side. And I try to find ways in teaching and writing to figure out how to think about China on its own terms and get out of distortions that come both with romanticization and with demonization.
It also seems from listening to the news and reading about China, but especially if you're just watching the evening news, for example, the TV reports coming off of the networks about official Chinese government or party policy, that you come away with this feeling of there's one Chinese, there's one China, when in fact, when you dig a little deeper, it does seem to be like diversity run amok. I mean, this is a country that is very difficult to quantify or to identify in terms of one people, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally. That would be the other thing that I think is most commonly misperception in the outside world. I mean, one of the things I'd say is there's a wonderful core of journalists reporting in China now. It's really an extraordinary time for people who have deep knowledge of China and good Chinese language skills, long-term commitment to covering the country, and also just some of them are just extraordinary writers. So it's a great time, in one sense, for coverage of China. And, you know, I make a point of trying to draw attention to the writers that I like the best and the great reporting they do. But somehow in the way that the news about China gets filtered down, the more it gets reduced to a soundbite, the more the diversity of the place that these writers highlight when they can write long form, the more it gets reduced down to these simplicities, these generalizations about the Chinese thinking a certain way. And if anybody asks me, what do the Chinese think about Japan or what do they think about America, or what do they think about the Chinese Communist Party, I want to ask, well, which Chinese do you mean? Because generational differences within China, it's an enormous chasm. Young Chinese have grown up in a world so different from their parents or grandparents. And so what we think of as a generation gap in any country there is really a chasm in many kind of psychological terms, as well as the mode of life. And then there are enormous regional differences. There's a lot of local pride, even among people who at certain moments are very nationalistic or patriotic. And there are ethnic differences of what we recognize. It's often said that 90% of Chinese are Han Chinese, members of the same ethnicity, but that means 130 million or so people living in the People's Republic of China aren't Han Chinese. We hear in the news about events in Tibet, so we're aware of Tibetan differences in Xinjiang, so we might know that Uyghurs are different, but then there are dozens and dozens of other subgroups. The way in which some urban Chinese speak about migrants from the countryside eking out a living in their cities are with the same kind of disparaging terminology and jargon that would be used toward toward illegal immigrants from Mexico in the United States. Yet another story that's important about China that has to do with the diversity you were describing.
You're listening to Jeffrey Wasserstrom. He's the author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know. Well, one of the assumptions many Americans make, I'm sure, is that it's an atheist state. Help clarify that for us.
Well, there's been a boom in interest in religion, resurging interest in old religions, and then also interest in new religions that are either amalgamations of different traditions. You know, the most famous example of a new religion that gained a lot of adherence was the Falun Gong sect that was then banned and, you know, has been cracked down on very hard. It was in part a set of beliefs that mixed traditional ideas about healing and health and meditation practices and various things with new ideas filtering in from different places. There are a variety of other kinds of new combinations of beliefs. But then there's also been a dramatic rise in evangelical Christianity in China, conversion rates. There are officially recognized branches of Christianity within China where the top official in that religious group has to in some way show subservience to the Chinese Communist Party. So the Chinese Communist Party, even if it's itself, recognizes some religious groups as okay. But then there are often underground or house church, as they're called, sometimes versions of the same Christian subset. So you'll have this officially recognized Catholic church within China that has bishops that cannot recognize the superiority of the Pope because nothing can stand above the Chinese Communist Party. Some people are Catholics within that officially recognized ones, but others are Catholics within a kind of underground version of that. At the same time, there's a resurging interest in Buddhism and Taoism and in a variety of local belief systems. There's really a search for meaning going on in China that has something to do with declining intense belief in the faith-like aspects of Chinese communism, which in the 50s and 60s, it really did have very much the quality for many people of a religious belief and of a kind of Chinese communism, especially under Mao, who was a charismatic figure, had many of the trappings of spiritual as well as political creed. And many people have lost faith with that aspect.
China's also viewed from this side of the world anyway as a big brother state where government's always watching you and dictating what you can and cannot do. And yet there was just a recent report in The Economist of all kinds of reform rallies that were rising up, I think some were in Guangdong province, that were aimed at freedom of press. It had to do with some censorship of some local newspapers. Is that common around China, that people will and can rise up? In this case, I think it said that the Communist Party was turning a blind eye, as much as it could anyway, and trying to ignore what was going on rather than crack down the way you would expect a totalitarian state to do.
Yeah, well, there are. That opens up all kinds of questions. There are tens of thousands of mass incidents, as they're called, protests involving a significant number of people every year in China. And they take place on a range of issues, and they're met with a variety of responses by the state. If you carry with you in your mind the idea that a Communist Party-run state is like George Orwell's 1984, there are just all kinds of things that mess with that, including the fact that these protests take place in areas like Tibet and Xinjiang, where protest is treated with incredible firmness, and the state comes closest to behaving in the classic Big Brother 1984 kind of form. But the other protests are treated by the government in a conciliatory fashion. They give in to some of the demands of the protesters in an idea of trying to get them off the streets, or they only arrest some of the leaders and assume that the ordinary people who joined in a protest should be treated lightly. There are various things that tip things in one way or the other. One of the things that matters is which part of the country the protests take place in. And you mentioned that these recent anti-censorship rallies were in Guangdong, which is a part of China that is closest to Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, even though it's part of the People's Republic of China, it's the furthest from being a 1984 kind of state. There's a lot more freedom of press in Hong Kong than there is in any other part of China. The parts of China that are closest to it are often most influenced by Hong Kong trends. So you see a difference regionally. There are other things that tip the balance toward a harsher or more lenient view toward protests. One of the key ones is the Chinese government, in part because of its awareness of how Eastern European communism fell, they want to avoid letting things take place that look like the things that brought down organizations like them there. And they know that in Poland, Solidarity, which was an organization that linked intellectuals and workers, connected them throughout the country, and had a connection to various kinds of ideas that flowed across different borders, geographical and social, that brought the state down. So they crack down very hard at anything that starts to swell to a movement that seems to have the potential to link people in different parts of the country and of different social classes. That's dealt with harshly. But when there's a quite localized protest or a quite specific issue only involved, then there can be more leniency. We've seen more leniency, for example, with not in my backyard style environmental protests, where people in one locale will rally to try to bring about the closure of a chemical plant that's seen as spewing toxic waste into the air or into the waterways. But I expect the government would crack down hard if this led to what was defined as a nationwide environmental movement with clearly organized structure. They don't want a competing organizational structure. They're not so concerned about small groups of people in individual places rallying about individual issues. And there even sometimes the central government sees this as a useful way of keeping local officials who sometimes are out of step with center desires and can be causing problems by doing things inappropriately. They can see this as in part a check on that. They can see these as having partly a healthy effect on society.
This is Jeffrey Wasserstrom. He's the author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know. The New York Times reported recently that you can expect the Chinese economy to grow, but not at the rapid pace it's been growing, and it's going to slow down mainly because of the emerging labor shortage that is caused by the one-child family policy and more Chinese students staying in school longer. What do you think the Chinese government will do? Will they change the one-child family policy? Is that likely to be one of the reforms that this new premier seeks?
Well, it's possible. It's become much more thinkable. There's widespread opinion among experts who track this kind of thing that, however, Americans always had a real problem with the birth limitation policy because of its interference with personal choice and things like that. But even in terms of pure demographic and pragmatic things of what sort of size of a labor market you need, there's been a clear consensus in recent years that whatever you thought about the policy originally, it doesn't make sense anymore to try to limit births, especially because, as often happens with development, at least in the cities, increasingly middle-class populations are choosing to have very small families, in some cases, just one child, or in some cases, none. But the Chinese Communist Party hates to admit having made a mistake. So there's been a real slow process of being willing to consider this because of that unwillingness or slowness in admitting mistakes of the past. I think what is going to be crucial going forward is the Chinese Communist Party has gotten into a kind of trap that a lot of the stories that it liked to tell about why it deserved to rule have started having less and less purchase. Early on, it told the story that it deserved to rule because its officials were less corrupt than those of the Nationalist Party that it displaced. Well, very few people now think of the Chinese Communist Party within China or outside as being made up of people who are singularly immune to corruption. There have been all kinds of corruption scandals. So that story no longer really works. An early story of the Communist Party was that it was committed to equalizing wealth within the country and doing away with the divide between rich and poor. Well, China now has really high disparity between rich and poor, so that story doesn't really work anymore. But the other story they tell that has had a good deal of valence is that under their watch, China's economy has boomed. Lots of people have done better because of this, and those who haven't done better, they'll get their turn next, which traps them into needing to keep having relatively high growth rates for this story to work. So the idea of a slowing economy, even a dramatically slowing economy in China, could still grow faster than most countries in the world and yet also create problems for a party that has yoked itself to this idea that the people should judge it by its ability to keep growing and growing and growing.
James Fallows wrote an article in a recent Atlantic Monthly. I think it was called Mr. China Comes to America. And I found it really fascinating, but I wasn't sure whether it was a report on isolated incidents or whether there's really anything to it that you can extrapolate about the future of manufacturing in China. He talks about Foxconn technology, building these huge manufacturing centers, putting these huge dormitories next to them, bringing the folks in from rural areas. But then when they get there, they have to, after they work for a while, they're putting up suicide nets to prevent the workers from diving off the upper floors and killing themselves. And there's a workforce churn. Some of the folks are going back to the rural areas. And his point is that, manufacturing may not be in as great a shape in the future as it has been predicted. What's your thoughts on what this worker unrest is going to lead to as far as the Chinese economy is concerned?
There have been shifts in, I think the labor force issue and the need for China to move toward a different model for development, whether it is doing more at a higher end of manufacturing than simply being the workshop of the world that it aspired to for a while. I think there does have to be a shift there of some sort. And I think within China, there's a clear awareness of this. They've been trying to figure out how China can be thought of as a place that innovates as well as simply copies and builds cheaper things that are done other places, and that in stages of development, that's something that countries simply have had to do. There's also been a shifting within China of where some of the hubs of manufacturing are, with Foxconn being an example. Foxconn's factories, massive plants associated with South China, they're now starting to open up more manufacturing plants in other parts of China that may be at an earlier phase of this kind of levels of urban development than that South China, in part moving closer to where some of the labor potential is, rather than depending on migrants from those areas being determined to make the trek towards what they imagine is a better life, and often for them is a better life in South China. Labor unrest is something that is incredibly important to keep an eye on in China. As long as there's enormous supply of labor in any setting, it's hard for worker activism to get any kind of traction because employers can simply say, if you make any trouble, we'll just get other people. So with a kind of tightening up of labor supply, there becomes more room for pushback from labor about conditions, about all sorts of things. What the Communist Party has done, and again, this is an example of different metrics toward different things, is to have different attitudes toward labor activism, depending what form it takes. They're very quick to stamp down on anything that looks like an independent labor organization, an independent union. But when there's just a short-term strike about a very specific condition that doesn't seem to be getting very organized, then sometimes they will have to meet the demands of this. So those are all very, you know, very complicated things. I'm not an economist, so it's hard for me to make predictions about the shift of some production to other parts of the world, which has clearly happened with some things that used to be made in China now being made in the U.S. But probably the bigger story there is some things that used to be made in China taking advantage of very low wage labor now being made, gravitating toward places in Southeast Asia, down the line, perhaps Africa. Expectations are rising in China, which can make it difficult to produce things at the low, low cost that was the story in China during the first stage of its economic boom.
I have room for one last question, Jeff. I'd like to ask you about what starts in America as a major debate regarding the size of the defense budget, but related to it, of course, is what's going on around the rest of the world. How powerful is today's Chinese military? Does America really need to fear the growth and the development of this military as China's economy grows?
A couple of points are worth making. One is that China at the moment spends even more of its budget on domestic security than it does on the military. So in other words, the funding of forces to keep control at home outstrips the amount spent to project force abroad. And I think that shows that the Chinese Communist Party's greatest concern is staying in power, domestic stability. It knows that organizations like it have fallen around the world and keep falling, and it's trying to avoid those mistakes. To the extent the military itself is a concern, the concern really is for China's immediate neighbors. I think it's very clear that the Chinese government aspires to be clearly, once again, the dominant regional power. But I think this is an example of where an exaggerated fear of China can seep in. If we're imagining that China's eyeing invading us, I think that's going too far. I worry a lot about regional stability and the ways in which conflicts between China and its neighbors could become problematic. But I think some of the visions of the Chinese Communist Party as somehow growing stronger and stronger and ready to take over the world, I think that's hyperbolic. One of the books I like that came out a few years ago and will come out in a new edition soon is Susan Shirk, who was in the U.S. State Department for a while and is a political scientist. She called it China, Fragile Superpower. And she said when she described the title to American friends, they would say, fragile? You know, you're talking about China. And they'd raise their eyebrows at that term. But when she would tell this to Chinese friends, they'd raise their eyebrows at superpower, saying, you know, we're heading there, but we're not there yet. And I think it's interesting that she's reissuing the book this year. It came out in 2007. She's reissuing it now, and China has definitely gotten stronger in the interim, but she's still keeping that middle adjective, fragile, between China and superpower. And I think it's worth being there.
Well, the answer to this question and the questions I've raised and many others can be found in your book. It's China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know by Jeffrey Wasserstrom. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us today on Reader's Corner.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks.
Next week, Jill Gill, author of Embattled, Ecumenism, the National Council of Churches, the Vietnam War, and the Trials of the Protestant Left. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.